morning. House State Affairs Committee is online. It's Thursday, April 1st, 2004. President Representative Berkowitz, Representative Coghill, Representative Lynn, Representative Seat, myself, Representative Wyrock. Today we have a diverse calendar.
How about Holm?
I beg your pardon. Representative Holm. Representative Lynn is not present, but Representative Holm is. And we're going to start with House Bill number 476 on this Alaska Statehood Celebration Commission. If you go ahead, Mr. Shine, introduce yourself on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Shine, staff Representative Anderson. January 2009 will mark the 50th anniversary of Alaska's admission as the 49th state of the United States of America. It's important the state of Alaska recognize this landmark with a celebration of the state's magnificent heritage and to reflect upon the opportunities that 50 years of statehood have brought to the state. House Bill 476 will establish the Alaska Statehood Celebration Commission. This commission shall consist of 17 members, 12 public members appointed by the governor, of which at least two shall be residents of and be appointed from each of the four judicial districts in Alaska. The presiding officer from the Alaska House of Representatives and the Alaska Senate will appoint a majority and minority member from each body. The governor and a designee, will occupy the 17th seat. The Alaska Statehood Celebration Commission shall plan and administer all official state activities leading up to the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. The commission will initiate a public process to solicit ideas about the celebration. In addition, the commemorative quarter honoring the state of Alaska, House Bill 467, which was heard in this committee last week, will be issued in the same calendar year in which the Alaska Statehood Celebration occurs. And I've done a little bit of research, and other states have done similar pieces of legislation. Wyoming and Utah currently are their statehood centennial legislators created a commission for their centennial celebration.
Mr. Shine, didn't we do something like this for the 25th anniversary?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Questions by committee?
Mr. Chairman, did Mr. Joe Vogler get a copy of this yet? Oh, wait a minute. I think he did.
He passed away about
that
5 years
historical,
ago.
Mr. Chairman. It's April Fool's Day.
Oh, that's right.
Be a long day.
Everybody got that feeling.
We're joined by Representative Grunberg for the record. Representative Grunberg, we're talking about House Bill 476, establishing the Statehood Celebration Commission. And we're gearing up, revving up, engaging brains early morning. After a long night?
Mine's still in neutral, maybe reverse.
Representative Coghill.
Maybe just some discussion on some of my ignorance on this, but in formulating this commission or committee, this commission, we're going to span how many years with a commission?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, the effective date is January 1st of 2005, so there's going to be about 3.5 to 4 years of planning, and other states, and looking at Wyoming and Utah, I have a copy of their pieces of legislation here, instituted legislation similar in the same kind of time frame, leading up to centennial or 50th anniversary celebrations. It also is important enough, as I think Alaska does as well, to plan ahead and initiate, and including a public process for initiating ideas.
Mr.
Kaiser.
And on page two, we're talking about those of us in the House would have representatives on this. And I'm sorry for not having totally digested this, but we are going to have at least two legislatures that are going to be a part of this. So how would we span that? Are those appointed in the first appointment round going to stay throughout? Or do we do that if we have a new legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I don't have a definite answer for you. I think that would be up to the discretion of the governor, since he's going to be appointing the members, and I think that they would probably appoint two new members to the commission. That was my assumption.
On page two, section two, line eight, it says the Speaker of the House shall appoint one member of each minority-majority caucus. So same with the Senate. And I'm just wondering if we need to make provision for transition from one legislature to another. That's all. Minority leader anticipates another governor, so. But it's true, if this does cross over a gubernatorial year, so.
It's just a parliamentary question. Is that part of the bill?
Mr. Shine, if you could take those questions under advisement, and Representative Coghill, could you hold your line of thought on that while we turn to a witness from New York on this other bill? That'd be all right. Mr. Connor, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Just a sec. Let me take care of some procedural matters. We have before the committee House Bill 527. During the last time we heard this bill and today, I had invited testimony from Berkshire Hathaway's Chairman Warren Buffett, and through a series of telephone calls and then finally correspondence, on what the desire for Mr. Buffett's testimony is, which is in my letter, which is part of your packet. Mr. Buffett's office has responded as to issues related to the tension between corporate governance, the desire to maintain a flourishing capitalist system in our country, and the role of state government on the oversight of corporations. I wanted to ensure that Alaska maintains a healthy both oversight through its public policies that they be enacted by the legislature and a system of laws that invite participation by the private sector into the state. On the other hand, we want to make sure that those corporations doing business here with its citizens and with our people do so in an honest, ethical, and in a way that profits both the corporation and our people. And if there are corporations that do acts that harm the individuals that invest in the corporations, through whatever means, that the state of Alaska has appropriate tools to enforce the public policies that we enact, exact some sort of retribution to cover the costs of state government's actions in enforcing its laws, and to ensure that those publics that are, and peoples that are harmed by improper corporate actions are fully compensated for the harm that is done to them by improper acts. Towards that end, we also communicated through the office of the New York Attorney General's office, Elliot Spitzer, because of his very aggressive activities in enforcing state policies against mutual funds and other corporations that have done things like charging exorbitant fees or hidden fees against the public and attempting to recover those. And in fact, Mr. Spitzer's office has been, in some cases, the dog wagging the federal government's tail on enforcement actions. And I think that from at least the press accounts that I've read, some of the actions taken by the New York Attorney General's office have been very admirable in terms of sniffing out wrongdoing, bringing them to the public's light, and gaining some sense of corporate responsibility through legitimate state policies and oversight. We're joined by Representative Lynn for the record. So to that extent, I had asked Attorney General from New York, Elliot Spitzer, to testify. With us on the line is Gary Connor, the first Deputy Bureau Chief of the Investment Protection Bureau from the Office of the New York State Attorney General's Office. And I had, Mr. Connor has graciously appeared, which is at his noon hour, for this committee to discuss the public policy that the New York State Attorney General's Office has to enforce its philosophy in enforcing those laws, and to provide himself to the committee for questions that we might consider adopting in Alaska, if it's the committee's desire to do so, in House Bill 527 or other mechanisms that we have before us at this time. So, Mr. Connor, can you hear me?
Can.
And I hope I have accurately portrayed our conversations and why we've asked you to testify this morning.
I believe so, and I thank the committee for inviting me to testify. It's very gracious of you.
And why don't you go ahead, Mr. Connor, identify yourself for the record, give us your testimony, and then we'll open it up, you up to cross-examination.
No problem.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Gary R. Connor. I'm the first Deputy Bureau Chief in Investment Protection Bureau, the office of New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. As I said, I thank the committee for permitting me to testify. As I understand it, it would be helpful if I could explain the New York statutory scheme, describe some of the things we have been doing, some of our approaches, and some of the corporate response. In that light, however, I would like to preface my comments by saying that I am not knowledgeable with the Alaska statutes. So I can only really address the New York system, which is somewhat different than most all states. New York has never adopted the Uniform Securities Act. Therefore, we are different in that we do not have administrative hearings. We don't issue orders. The state securities laws were enacted in 1921 in New York, well before the federal statutes. We register the issuers of securities, not the securities themselves. Thus, we file broker-dealer statements, investor-advisor statements, commodity broker-dealer statements. We do not analyze and review the offerings themselves in advance. The statute is largely an anti-fraud statute. It's designed to prevent fraud in the offer of securities, commodities. Fraud is defined in New York somewhat differently than elsewhere. The definition really is any act tending to deceive or mislead the purchasing public. The act is designed to protect the inexperienced investor, and it's to be liberally construed. One of the advantages we have in New York is that in any civil action we may bring or misdemeanor prosecution, we do not have to show intent, nor do we have to show proof of a sale, nor do we have to show damages. It's a per se liability statute, meaning a violation, whether knowing or not, can get you in jeopardy in terms of a civil action. The statute also provides that any violation can be either a criminal or civil, result in a criminal or civil penalty. The distinction on the criminal side is that while every violation is a misdemeanor, under certain parts of the statute, we have felony jurisdiction, and there we do need intent, but the basic civil action, we don't. The main tool that we use, since we are more an enforcement agency as opposed to a registration agency, is that we are able to issue subpoenas and request information prior to bringing any action. The penalty for refusing to respond, refusing to testify or show up, is a misdemeanor. The investigations can be conducted based on any source of information. They also can be based on an allegation of fraud or just merely in the public interest. The basic investigations that we do, we keep confidential. We do not discuss our investigations normally in the press with members of the public. In large part, we are trying to protect the subjects of the investigation because although we are investigating something, we do not know at the beginning whether or not there actually is wrongdoing. So we believe that those we are looking at need protection there. Because it is an investigation and not an adjudicatory proceeding, the basic due process rights do not kick in our investigations. For instance, witnesses do not get transcripts while the investigation is in progress. We do that so that we are not affecting public opinion about our investigation or tainting anyone during the course of the investigation. At the end of our investigation, we then make certain decisions as to how to proceed. One way is civil, one way is criminal, or we can go both. One of the tools that we have, which we used in our Merrill Lynch investigation, is that we can obtain ex parte orders from the court prior to commencing an action. Those orders direct the witnesses to appear, to produce documents, and we can also get ex parte injunctive relief based upon a standard of what is proper and expedient. It is not your normal preliminary injunction standard. It's a much lower standard. The ex parte orders result in public testimony in which the public can attend and hear whatever is being said by the witnesses. Again, because it is an investigation still, this is not a situation where there is cross-examination. It is mainly a fact-gathering process. If we decide to bring a civil action, which we often do, the remedy in the civil action is a permanent injunction from the securities business. The statute is all or nothing. A judge has no discretion. If a judge finds wrongdoing, the judge either gives a permanent injunction or there is no injunction. The court does not bar people for a period of years. In those actions, we can also get restitution, we can get damages, and we can have receivers appointed, as well as other types of creative injunctive relief. On the criminal side, as I indicated, we have both misdemeanors and felonies. The criminal provisions basically prohibit fraud, deception, concealment, fictitious sales, and other things. Any promises or representations as to the future, which is beyond reasonable expectation, is illegal. Any representation which is false, where the person knew the truth, could have known the truth, or had no reasonable effort, made no reasonable effort to determine the truth, are all prohibited and illegal under the statute. And as I said before, we have two criminal felony statutes involving intentional fraud and deception or schemes to defraud. If we have any criminal violation that we are proceeding on, we can also use the state's penal laws, which means filing of false documents become an issue in other such statutes. Besides the main securities laws, which are called the Martin Act, we have other statutes in New York. Under our business corporation law, we can remove directors and officers from corporations. And we also have, a broad statute under the executive law in which any fraud or illegality in the course of business is actionable by us, and that could be a federal, state, or a local illegality. That's generally our overview of our statutory scheme. If I may, I'll just review briefly our analyst investigation, our IPO investigation, and talk a little about the mutual fund investigation.
Thank you.
3 years ago, we started investigating Merrill Lynch based upon newspaper articles by some reporters that had sort of been getting minor attention in the press, that research reports by analysts for the various companies was not really accurate. And that's a difficult subject to address because it's a complex financial analysis that the analysts go through. And we started investigating based upon newspaper reports. And we looked at two companies, GoTo.com and InfoSpace, both of which was covered by Henry Blodgett at Merrill Lynch. And we started looking at the two deals. The GoTo deal, essentially Merrill Lynch downgraded the rating for the stock on the day that it was publicly announced Merrill Lynch would not be the banker for the deal. On InfoSpace, Merrill Lynch propped up the stock with high ratings while the stock price was plummeting, and they kept the ratings high until a merger and acquisition deal was consummated. Both were suspicious to us. We used our investigative powers. We went through witness after witness. And eventually we got to the gold in the case, which were the emails, which I think discussed publicly. Those emails revealed a corporate culture where the analysts and many other people at Merrill Lynch were very much aware that the ratings were not accurate. We actually found one email which spoke about the code words that were being used between communications between different analysts, and it was generally understood by them that certain ratings meant other things than what the public was being told. The heart of the case was that the public was told one thing about what the ratings meant, and Merrill Lynch itself knew that that information was inaccurate. The goal in Merrill Lynch that the Attorney General took, when he looked at his powers under the Martin Act, we obviously could have brought a criminal prosecution. The Attorney General was very clear, though. He did not want to bring Merrill Lynch down. He did not want to do this to a company. We've all seen Arthur Anderson and what happened there. That was never the goal of the Attorney General. What the Attorney General was trying to achieve is not so much punishment as trying to get the system to work, to be honest. As he said, I want the sunshine to disinfect this thing. The way to go about that, and it took a while, was to get Merrill Lynch to ultimately agree to certain reforms. The process was somewhat bumpy, however, because of the Merrill Lynch executives, as well as the attorneys, really found it difficult that there was any wrongdoing in the situation. And although we were clear that you can't have a rating system saying one thing and then internally use that as a secret code, the company itself seemed to be dumbfounded about what we were talking about. And one of the ways the Attorney General got their attention was by bringing one of these ex parte orders in which the emails and other documents were attached to the court papers, and then the public became aware of what was really going on. It was very important for the Attorney General to undergo this type of investor education as opposed to keeping this somewhat quiet in some buried court order. The Attorney General wanted it public. He wanted people to know, hey, there's a problem with the ratings by these investment banking companies. The settlement with Merrill Lynch ultimately led to certain reforms, certain separations of investment banking. The bankers were not to have influence on the analysts. The analysts weren't really to be used to get banking business. They were to try to be objective. That settlement, which was $100 million, resulted in New York giving half of the money, $50 million, to the North American Securities Administrators Association, which represents the 50 states and the provinces of Canada, as well as Mexico. The money was divided among the states by population, and the North American Securities Administrators Association received $2 million itself. From that moment on, we started working with all the states, and we commenced the much larger analyst investigation, which eventually led to the $1.4 billion Wall Street reform with 10 of the biggest investment banking institutions in the country. The effort on the Wall Street analyst investigations and settlement was a joint one. Not only were the states part of this, the SEC was part of it, the NASD was part of it, and it was essentially a broad investor regulatory system looking at an industry. The investigation showed similar things as with Merrill Lynch, and again, there was certain lack of understanding that there was wrongdoing, and we also found in the larger investigation that the companies themselves were very jealous about being at a disadvantage from their competitors. And fairly early on, they took the position they would go for the reforms, but they wanted other banking institutions involved, and that ultimately happened. As part of the analyst investigations, we also looked at the issue of IPOs, the initial public offerings, and what we found is that as part of this banking analyst rating system where the ratings were not necessarily accurate so that the companies could get banking business and prop up some of the companies, is that the executives of some of the companies that they were covering and rating were given advantageous IPOs, these initial public offerings, more or less from our view as favors for turning over banking business to the investment banking house. We then commenced an action in which we sought to get the return of the monies that the executives received from their IPO allocations. We felt that those monies belonged to the corporations, that these were not the individuals who should benefit, and ultimately the shareholders were to benefit. And I'm happy to say the three executives settled with us. Part of that settlement was funding law school arbitration clinics to help the investors. The current issue that we have on the table now is the mutual fund investigation. And what we found out was that by bringing the initial analyst investigations, we started to receive information from around the country about various other wrongdoing in the industry. And what we found with mutual funds, which I know is widely reported, is that many companies were disclosing in their prospectuses that investors could only make trades at a certain rate and that they could not time their trades after the markets closed or otherwise to go in and out of the market and get an advantage over the long-term investors, which is what the mutual fund industry was designed for. We also found late trading, which is trading after 4 p.m., that's prohibited by the SEC. In those cases, the first one we settled with Mr. Stern. Since that time, we've gone different ways. Some companies have settled with us. Some we've had to file our actions against. And then we have brought criminal prosecutions against a number of individuals. Again, the Attorney General's policy was not to bring down the companies, but rather to clean up the issues, make the public aware, and if the company said one thing, that's what they had to follow. The settlements in the mutual fund cases have also brought other types of remedies. For instance, in one case, eight directors from the board are agreeing to resign because of their conduct in approving certain conduct that was prohibited. We've also addressed the fees that mutual funds charge, and in many of the settlements, the fees are being reduced, certainly over a five-year period. The fee issue comes from the fact that most investors, the average investor, does not really know what the fee is for a mutual fund, and by not knowing, investors cannot fairly make a choice between different funds as to where they'll invest their money. Again, as with the analyst case, the issue really comes down to disclosure. Were people really told, the investor that is, what was going on? And if they weren't, that was wrongdoing, and that's something that the Attorney General sought to reform. The contract, those cases continue. We have other things on our agenda. The issues that have arisen rose from the investigations and has gotten some publicity is the alleged perception that the federal government and the states are at odds over some of these investigations, and that simply is not true. With the mutual fund investigations, except for the first one, we have worked with the SEC, we've worked with other states, we did that with the analyst investigations. The issues sometimes come down to the fact that we have criminal jurisdiction in New York, which the SEC does not have, and when you have criminal jurisdiction, there are various safeguards that play to the investigation. Certainly when one is in the grand jury, we cannot talk about that, and some of our cases, it looks like we spring them, but really there's certain prohibitions on us. The overall, I think, policy that the Attorney General has adopted, as I said, is that he really just wants honesty in the business place. No one is against businesses. No one's against making profits. It's really, is there honesty with the average investor? Do I, do you, do you know what you're getting into? Do you know what the rules are? If you do, that's a fair system. If the rules are bent, if they're told to you one way, not the other, or there's something else, that's wrong. That's where the action will go. And again, the Attorney General is not out to bring a company down, rather clean up the system. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah, there's a number of questions by the committee, Mr. Connor. I appreciate your giving us this overview. I do know that with 41 days left in our session, it may be difficult to do an omnibus sort of securities law, but it's helpful to the committee to at least have this information. I wondered in one certain respect, we have a $28 billion fund that we manage for the state of Alaska that that is charged with following prudent investor rules and returning an investment on that fund to help fund government and provide dividends to the people and preserve for future generations. Some of the investments that it's been involved with are the most significant involving the state because of the billions of dollars it manages. Does your office handle mergers and acquisition issues? And, for example, and I followed this with a permanent fund in its past minutes with Time Warner mergers and acquisitions or Putnam investments. Does your office pursue those kind of issues as well?
We really don't investigate mergers and acquisitions. We might get into it from an antitrust viewpoint as opposed to a securities issue, but that's not the primary focus in our bureau here.
I see. And then the other sort of issue for Alaska to determine is New York is the hotbed of investment activity in the world, basically, because of Wall Street. You had indicated, I think, that the name of your statute was the Martin Act?
Act, yes.
And was that adopted, what, in the 20s?
1921 it was effective.
And is it because of all the securities and investment activities of Wall Street that led New York to adopt these kind of statutory measures?
It wasn't necessarily Wall Street. It was just general investments. We even today see a lot of boiler rooms, a lot of fly-by-night deals, and a lot of that was going on back in the early 1920s, and that prompted the legislature here to consider different types of bills. And it took a while to get out, but 1921 is when it came out, and it wasn't just Wall Street. It was investments overall.
And then two questions, and I'll stop and let turn over the committee. One is, when you bring an action against Merrill Lynch or other entities, do you send out a notice to all the state attorney generals saying, we're doing this, you're welcome to join us, or we invite your participation, or do people just learn about it on their own?
We don't send out a formal notice. What we will often do is notify the North American Securities Administrators Association and give them a heads up that we're doing this. We've handled the situation of working with other states in different ways. On the analyst, the Wall Street matter, we did work with the National Association of Securities Administrators Association, and basically any state that wanted to participate could participate. And we divided the top investment banking organizations up among the different states. So we kind of opened it up there. With the mutual fund cases, what we have been doing, and Massachusetts does this also because they're one of the leaders on mutual funds, is that we trade off cases with other states or we will work with another state. For instance, we're working with several different states, Colorado, Massachusetts, and we work with the SEC around the country in their regional offices. Some of the exceptions to that are when we have criminal cases, and those we will keep here, but we're fairly open to working with other states, other agencies.
Okay, then my final question is I'm asking you, going to ask for your own opinion or editorial comment. Alaska is 4 hours removed from New York. We're geographically distant from New York, and we're a much smaller state in population and corporate activity in general, although we are a very rich resource-based state inviting lots of corporate participation. What are the policy or practical impediments or benefits to the state of a state like Alaska adopting such a pervasive, aggressive securities investigation scheme here, such as New York has?
I think the advantage that we have, quite frankly, is that we have our criminal jurisdiction. And that is a pretty powerful tool because someone coming in to give testimony or produce documents for us, they never really know what we're going to do. And our policy is not to make a determination on ultimately how we're going to proceed until towards the end of an investigation when we have a handle on the facts. I think it's that criminal threat and the ex parte order I spoke about with injunctive relief that acts as a deterrent and certainly moves us to settlements quicker than we might normally move.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Connor, we appreciate you and your office, Attorney General Spitzer, participating. This is the first time I've heard of something like this happening, and we appreciate the cooperation of New York in a far state like Alaska. That's the first thing.
I thank you very much.
I find it very interesting. We have a very small staff, and believe it or not, not well-funded. Nothing like what you have.
Well, I hate to interrupt you there, but most people don't know that we only have about 12 lawyers working on these big Wall Street cases. We really are not as big as the public perception is.
And you must be working 24/7s, right?
We're like the little engine that could. We just keep puffing and puffing and think we'll get a rest one day, and we don't.
Well, that's my hat, if I were wearing one, would be off to you. The question that comes to mind is, what was the legislature's role in this, and what is it, if any?
Are you talking about the current investigations, or?
Yes.
They're not really involved, from what I can see. I mean, we in the legislature in New York, I mean, we submit different bills to try and improve our statutory scheme, but the legislature really hasn't been involved. I think the other elected official in New York who has been very active is the state controller. The controller's office, which governs the state pension funds, has been active in getting other states, North Carolina, California in particular, now I believe it may be all 50, to try and come up with principles that companies must follow if they wish to have the state investments, and the state investments are quite huge. So we've seen a lot of activity there, and that's a different way of approaching the problem. It's saying, I have the money here, I'll invest it with you, but you've got to do X, Y, and Z.
And that is all done administratively through the comptroller's office?
Yes.
Is it done by regulation or by informal policies? Or
informal policies. There's a statement of principles that some of the controllers have put out, North Carolina in particular. And it's really the guidelines for investing the state's money. The state controller really is the person responsible for the state pension fund. His decision as to where to invest it by statute, and the policies are really guidelines that he and others come up with. And that's a powerful tool, I think.
We don't have a controller in that role here. What we have are pension boards that are independent, and the permanent fund, which you may have heard of, also has a board of trustees that is also independent. And this committee has looked at, in some legislation a few weeks ago, the board's, the permanent fund board's powers and guidelines, but they're statutorily very general. And I take it that what you're talking about are fairly detailed guidelines.
They're not that detailed. I think mainly because the controller is the deciding person for the where the investments go, that he has this authority to set conditions on where to put that money. And the principles, from what I understand, are only a few pages long, but they do make certain requirements of companies. Now, whether or not there are more detailed guidelines and positions and other documents that have not been made public, that I don't know.
My final line of questioning, Mr. Chair, what can Alaska do to participate given the parameters that I've discussed? We're far away, small, not well-funded, not nearly as sophisticated as you, and not anywhere near as close to the center of action as you. Anything that we can do to cooperate with you, anything you can do to cooperate with us, what can we do state to state to improve the situation or help?
Well, I think one of the things that helps is when certain companies are located in states not other than New York, and that happens a lot, is often the state administrators, securities administrators, are more knowledgeable about those companies and their activities. And because a lot of trading goes through New York, we generally have jurisdiction somehow, and I think one thing that can be done is for other states to contact us to see what assistance we can provide and help with, and just generally get whatever knowledge we have about the industries. And for us, the help would be just knowing about what's going on out there, because if it's going out on in Alaska, it's certainly going on in New York and other places.
I guess I do have one more line.
One more, and then we'll just address it.
We have developed and are developing, with a small group of other states, I don't believe New York is one of them, a group that's very competitive state to state in trust administration. And we are constantly revising our trust laws to be more competitive. And this group includes Delaware, Rhode Island, I think North Dakota's involved, states you wouldn't necessarily would think would be in the forefront, but they're relatively easy for these the group that's involved professionally, and this includes bankers and trust lawyers, estate planning lawyers, so that this group can move fairly quickly. However, there's not any oversight over this group that I can see at the state level. Have you had any indication of anything going on there?
I'm not really aware of that whole area in terms of trust administration. How New York really works, other than when something's going on here, is through the North American Securities Administrators Association. There's lots of working groups there that we get involved with, and there is interaction with the public and the businesses. I'm unaware of the informal groups you're speaking of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. Does anyone else have any questions, Mr. Connor? Yeah, Representative Coghill.
Just one, and I appreciate you coming for the committee. One of the things that you said kind of piqued my interest in the ability to hold criminal penalty over an investigation. And one of the things that we're always looking for here is how do we keep government from being intimidating and still be able to produce good results. And can you give me some idea of the accountability structure there?
Well, in terms of the accountability within this office, decisions about whether to bring a case criminal or not are made at the very highest levels, and we have many levels of supervisory review on that, and there are policy decisions as well as fact discussions made throughout the agency. The accountability at the end of the day, it's the Attorney General to the public, and he has that trust of the public, and if he misuses that trust, then the public has a way of dealing with that during the next election. So it's really an accountability system in the office that goes up to the Attorney General, and then he has to face the public with what he's doing with his powers.
Mr. Chairman, just to give you an idea of what happens in New York in selecting your Attorney General.
The Attorney General is a public official. He runs for office at the same time as the governor, lieutenant governor, and controller. Each political party puts up its candidate. It's a regular election. It's not held during presidential election years, and it's not held during the election for mayor of New York. It's really a separate election, and it's statewide.
And that has been true since the beginning of your securities law?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Just for your information, Mr. Connor, we have representatives on this committee from Anchorage, Alaska, Homer, Alaska, Fairbanks, and North Pole, Alaska, and Juneau, Alaska. So it's... It's a pretty diverse committee representing a broad range of philosophic and political views, and we welcome you and your staff up here sometime.
If I get up there, I'll be glad to come and visit.
Any further questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming and testifying to us, and I was wondering, is your opinion that if you had adopted the Uniform Securities Act, that basically you wouldn't have been able to proceed in any of these investigations?
I don't know if we wouldn't have been able to proceed. We have looked at the Uniform Securities Act, and while we are not generally or conceptually opposed to the administrative parts of it, that New York's Martin Act gives us more power than the Uniform Securities Act, and that's where we part from our colleagues who have adopted it. We think the Martin Act, again, with its ability to get these ex-party orders, the investigations, and the criminal prosecution abilities, gives us a lot of clout. But I couldn't say whether the Uniform Act would have absolutely precluded us from doing what we're doing.
And the other thing that you said was that basically the decisions made that I'm trying to find my notes here, that a person that's guilty under the civil portion is just simply barred from further security action instead of having a variable time
And do you think that that's been important so that it's all or nothing, or?
I think that is important because whenever one goes into the judicial system, quite honestly, every lawyer thinks they have the greatest case in the world, and someone's not going to come out happy. So you're always taking a chance, even though you may evaluate your case one way, the courts can view it a different way. So I think the fact that if you push this before a judge, the possibility that you're going to get permanently barred from the industry and all the implications that has is a great deterrent. Of course, what I didn't explain before, and I will now, is that we as an agency and institution, we can consent on our own to a less than permanent bar. But if it's put to a judge, that judge, it's all or nothing.
Okay, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. I really, it's very informative for me. I just one thing that you said just kind of bothered me.
Sure.
And that was that you said that the due process rights do not kick in during an investigative process. And
under U.S. Supreme Court decisions, case in particular in Iowa, is an investigation is viewed differently than an adjudicatory proceeding. When you're adjudicating something and making a determination based on the facts before you, the witnesses have rights to lawyers, there's regular cross-examination, transcripts are provided. The Supreme Court has indicated and held that in an investigation, those particular rights don't apply. In New York, what we have done is we generally take the position an attorney may be present during testimony for the purpose of advising a witness as to his or her rights and privileges, but it's not a participatory type of session. It's really an investigation and for us to try and determine what the facts are through the means that we think are best available. So that is a distinction.
Just as a follow-up, so you're maintaining that the Fifth Amendment rights don't apply during the investigative process?
Fifth Amendment rights apply during the investigative process. It's just some of the other traditional things, such as formal examination and a determination made by the agency. That part doesn't apply in an investigation. If we, at the end of an investigation, believe there's wrongdoing, we can't on our own do anything. We have to go to the court system. It's really that's where the due process rights fully kick in, and the courts will protect both parties in that situation.
Thanks for the clarification.
You're welcome.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on a couple of questions Representative Seaton, Representative Holm asked. With respect to the provision that does not give the judge the authority to issue less than a permanent injunction, has that ever been challenged on a separation of powers basis?
Not that I'm aware of. This particular policy, I guess, the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court, has interpreted the statute in New York as being that way, that it's an all-or-nothing statute. But I don't believe it's been challenged on a separation of powers situation.
And then secondly, I'm glad you clarified Representative Holmes' question, because I had some of the same questions. Representative Holm and I are also on the House Judiciary Committee, and we're dealing with different types of immunities, and the court talks about the link in the chain, we don't have to go into that, so Representative Holm knows what I'm talking about. Thank you very much, Mr. Connor.
Any further questions, Mr. Connor? Representative Lynn.
I'm one of the non-attorneys on this panel, so please excuse me, but on this investigation phase, can you force somebody to cooperate in the investigation? What if I say, I don't want to talk to you?
If a person doesn't want to talk to us, we usually have issued a subpoena already, and our options are two. One is to go into the civil part of the state Supreme Court, which is New York's trial court, and seek a court order directing the witness to appear and to testify. Obviously, during the testimony, they can take the Fifth Amendment. The other route we have is we can go in through the criminal system in the state Supreme Court and seek a misdemeanor determination. And obviously with a misdemeanor, there's certain penalties that the judge can impose on the witness, you know, whether it's incarceration, fines, or whatever. And then under both systems, we do have the powers of contempt that the court can use. So that's how the approach would go if a witness did not want to testify.
And that's before you go to trial, before they invite the attorney even committed a crime.
Yes, because the subpoenas really require the person to show up. They can assert all their privileges that they want on Fifth Amendment or anything.
Thank you.
One thing, if we can focus on policy as opposed to the judiciary kind of stuff, that's great. But Representative Groomberg.
I'd like to ask a question, maybe a little bit of field, but this is an unusual opportunity. And Mr. Connor, please, if I'm going a little bit outside your area, snark me off.
Gotcha.
This committee is taking a very active role, much more active than some of the other legislative committees. And I'd like to ask a couple of questions that you may just be knowledgeable about, and if you're not, that's okay. Do committees in the state legislature in New York do any investigatory stuff like they do in Congress? And secondly, do they ever issue subpoenas? Third, do they ever put people under oath?
I'm not the expert in that, but I do believe that there is some investigatory work that they do. They certainly hold hearings and public hearings and question witnesses, but I don't know all the finer details of that process.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Connor? Thank you, Mr. Connor, so much for sharing your lunch with us. As Representative Groomberg noted, it cannot be said the New York AG is out to lunch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. That was Representative Groomberg. Mr. Sarah, can you come forward, please? We have before the committee, committee substitute for House Bill 527, State Affairs, and Representative Holm, could you move that for discussion, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version H, committee substitute for House Bill 527. No,
State Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And there is one amendment that I'd like to offer. It's a conceptual amendment. And I'm going to move that amendment at this time for discussion purposes as well. And that'll be amendment number one. Mr. That's been passed out to the committee, I hope.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Mr. Sir, you've had a chance to review this committee substitute.
Very briefly.
Right. It does leave some things intact from the original bill. Section 1 stays intact. The record is the class of equity security holders is reduced from 500 to 250. From there on, things get a little bit different
yes.
from the original bill. And, for example, in the committee substitute, under Section 2, there is still the administrator is going to hold a separate account of fees received by the administrator. If for fees received, there is the penalty was increased from the original bill. You had increased the penalties under Section 3 from 2,500, I think, to 5,000.
No, from 2,500 to a maximum of 25,000.
To 25,000. I'm sorry, you multiplied it by 10 from 2,500 to 25,000.
That's correct.
And then you, for not more than, it was originally was 20, for multiple violations, you'd increase that?
Multiple knowing violations, I was increasing it from 25 to 100,000.
Right. And just for the committee's information, the committee substitute here increases that to 100,000 for civil penalty and 1,000,000 for multiple violations. I imagine you don't have much comment on these because they're sort of policy determinations.
That's correct. I think it's great that we would have the ability to fine that high. I doubt we would very often.
And I think it should be noted that from the memorandum from legal that it cannot be assessed, $1 million fine can't be assessed as a punitive measure. There has to be a balance.
That's correct.
That is imposed before a fine such as that could be imposed. But there are some corporations that are fully capable of paying $1 million in a heartbeat.
That is correct.
And in some instances where the penalty is egregious or over a continuing period of time or demonstrates a pattern of wrongful conduct, a penalty of $1 million may be appropriate in some cases where there's corporate wrongdoing and a long-established pattern.
It could be. A lot of the...
Actually, Mr. Usera, you have to identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Vincent Usera, Senior Securities Examiner with the Department of Community and Economic Development. Most of the fines we levy are in the smaller range and are meant to be corrective. A lot of them come from out of state, and we have to go chase the people down. We go get a judgment. We're empowered to reduce it to judgment and take the judgment to another state and collect it. That takes a lot of effort. If we were to do that with every perpetrator, $1 million would be very difficult to collect. But it would be nice to be able to assess a penalty where that is reasonable and warranted.
Let me just go through briefly this committee substitute. Same thing with Section 4 that increases the penalties in similar amounts. In Section 5, the administrator is authorized to issue orders, and among the sample penalties levied is the ability to collect restitution plus attorney's fees and costs to specifically allow that, so that if the division has to employ attorney's fees or it uses its own attorney generals to pursue those fees and costs should not be borne by the general public through its treasury. Those should be borne by the wrongdoers that have to pay these penalties.
That's correct. I would note that there was one change made where restitution is doubled, and that may be difficult to it must be doubled is what it says. That may be difficult to negotiate at times.
I have an inquiry, Mr. Chairman. We'll get to that. Section 6 and 7, I think, are same as the original bill. Do you have the bill there?
No, I don't.
Do you have a copy of the bill?
If you just mention what the subject is, I'm pretty sure I remember it.
Well, it's amended by adding new... Well, we'll get you the bill.
Section 7 is the change in the definition of investment advisor representative.
That's correct. Actually, what Section 6 does is if there's restitution to be paid to a harmed person, it must be two times the amount of loss caused to the person. Now, that is a double damages. That's a punitive measure.
Right.
To double the amount.
I would prefer that say may rather than must, because that puts us in a bind if we're... there are some people who... through benign neglect, do wrong. We can get them to pay back, but they don't warrant being punished. And this would put us in a difficult situation there.
I see. Let me run through the rest of this quickly, and then we'll come back to the comments and the committee's questions. Also under page 3, section 6, if you prevail in court, it requires the court to award to you, the division, the actual reasonable attorney's fees and actual reasonable costs incurred, including all your expert witness fees. And then that, again, is if there is wrongdoing found, the public should not be paying the cost of this and the witness fees that you may have to incur, but the wrongdoer should be required to pay that. To transfer the burden from the public to the perpetrator.
And I think that's fine. I'm not quite certain how that would work in terms of the actual logistics, because something's got to go someplace. It can't just come back into our coffers.
I understand. What I wanted to do is set this out as committee substitute as a policy matter, and it's got a long road to travel.
Right.
And it's also got debate in this committee. This is not a cram down. Finally, that essentially is what this CS does. The amendment that I've offered exempts the division from AS 3710-050A, which limits the fees you may collect. Mr. Usera, do you want to discuss?
I didn't hear what you said.
The fees that may be collected by the agency.
This is a statute that was enacted in 1990. I'm not sure what the impetus was, but it sort of lay dormant for a long time, and somebody rediscovered it recently. And what it says is essentially you cannot collect any more in fees than your actual costs of doing business. And quite honestly, that really limits us. We don't use all the fees that we receive, but it costs us about $2.5 million to do our business, and we bring in somewhere in the range of $10 to $12 million. So there's a generous contribution to the general fund there that would be taken away from us if this statute were to be adhered to. And I think an exemption is warranted in this case, and especially if you're going to give us back some of our fines, so that we can do the job we're empowered to do.
That was the point. I mean, I was searching around. I finally found that.
Right.
Sort of a seemed to me handcuffs on your division.
Very much so. And the state, quite honestly. And the state is the beneficiary of about $10 million.
And finally, I just want to follow up with Mr. Connor, and then I'll stop. I'm sorry for keeping. The court has. Mr. Connor talked about all kinds of money, like $50 million settlement to North America Securities and efforts on Wall Street and money coming back distributed to the states. What has been Alaska's share of that?
Alaska's total share of the global settlement was about $4.6 million.
And that was receipts to the general fund?
To the general fund, yes. It's been paid.
And spent.
I'm sure twice over.
Okay, I'm sorry to admit. Is there any questions? Representative Groomberg.
Yeah, I'm glad we're not moving this thing, because this is really a new kind of a draft is considerable. We've been working with Mr. USERRA and trying to get a hold of Jeff Bush dealing with the Takeover Bid Disclosure Act, and I do want to pursue that. I don't want to, I'm talking directly to Mr. USERRA here, Mr. Chairman, if I can, and I very much want to update that act, maybe taking the Indiana Act, so we have a good constitutional act on the books. And I would appreciate your assistance in that dispute, sir.
I'd be glad to talk with you at any time, sir.
Okay. We, just for your information, Representative Adelaide Herman and I put in a bill involving this in the 15th legislature, House Bill 488, and it was a broad title relating to that act. The act now is unconstitutional under an Illinois case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and our bill just simply repealed the act. We had not gotten into how we were going to create a new act. The bill never had a hearing, I don't think, never went anywhere, so we didn't get into the fix. But and I know you and I, Mr. USERRA, through the chair, have talked about repealing that act. I would be concerned about repealing it and not putting something else on the books. What do you think?
Well, quite candidly, in order to fix this act, we pretty well have to gut it.
Right.
In repealing it, we wouldn't be doing much harm. First of all, this came in 76. It has never been invoked. So it doesn't seem to be of any utility. Alaska's not a hotbed of merger activity. So there is the Williams Act, which requires it's a federal act requiring certain disclosures. And that's where our act runs afoul of the Williams Act and also runs afoul of the Commerce Clause.
Let me interrupt here a minute. I really want to stick to this bill and this amendment, and what I want to do is take the committee action on this amendment and adopting it to this CS, bring the next CS before the committee next time for action by the committee. If the committee agrees with this, we can move it on to the next committee referral, which is judiciary, to hash that out, Representative Groomberg. But let me, Representative Groomberg?
Yeah, I don't. Okay. I'm not going to just wait, but we'll pursue.
Sure. Is there any further discussion on Amendment Number 1? Is there an objection to Amendment Number 1? It's a conceptual amendment. You're going to have to discuss it with Ms. Bannister. Okay, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. Is there any further discussion on CS for, yes, Representative Groomberg?
Yeah, I had highlighted a few things, and I'd just like to bring up one of them, since Mr. USERRA mentioned it.
And then what we're going to do before we go to the next bill and incorporate this as a new CS, we're going to have public testimony. We have some more people who want to testify on this bill. So go ahead.
Okay, I will be prepared at the appropriate time on page 3, line 12, to change the must to may.
Correct.
And I don't know if you want me
Why
to
Why don't
do
we
that.
Just do that right now?
Okay.
That's page 3, line 12, changing the word must to may.
That's amendment 2?
Yes. Is there objection to that? That was recommended by the division. I agreed with that recommendation. So that, see no objection, Amendment 2, changing must to may on line 12, page 3, is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I want to at least flag some things that I had seen.
Correct.
And I just read through this. I planned to read it yesterday, and I'm afraid I didn't. On page 3, line 1, the word or, I'm wondering if that really should be and, because where we're talking about in the bill there, that the administrator, what administrator is, who's the administrator?
We're talking about the administrator, the Division of Administrative
Security.
Okay, the administrator of security may petition the Superior Court for a judgment for the amount of the civil penalty or the amount of restitution ordered. I don't know that those are disjunctive. Could there not be a case where you have a civil penalty plus restitution?
Yes, there are cases where that applies.
Then we probably should change the or to and, should we not?
Yes, sir.
It's difficult to say. If we can make the disjunctive and.
Yeah.
And or.
You don't do and or in statute, though.
No, I know that. That's
this is discretionary. And if you have the authority to do both, you can do either.
I agree. I think we should change or to and on page 3, line 1. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment is adopted.
And then just a couple of other things just that I had noticed. And again, I'm hesitant to do anything without us knowing what we're doing here. In subsection G, we're dealing with Rule 82 actual attorney's fees and actual reasonable costs. I think the court should have discretion in that matter. There may be a case where it's appropriate to award less, and I would rather say the court may award.
So on line 15, page 3, I agree with that, too. Page 3, line 15, changing the word shall to may. I don't see an objection by the committee. That amendment is adopted.
And finally, I had a question about all on line 17, but since it's a may, let's leave the word all in. And that was all that caught my eye. Oh, I just had to put a comment on the record on section 7. As those who are on the sit in on the Ways and Means Committee know, we've been dealing with the Quill case in the tobacco tax, which is long-arm jurisdiction in this area. And Section 7 looks like a Quill provision.
That's correct. I added Section 7.
And I appreciate that.
Section 7 is intended to be able to get all those wrongdoers, no matter where they are, if they're doing business in this state. And they make no question
about
that.
And it expands the concept of nexus.
So are there any further comments or questions? What I'd like to do is take public testimony on this bill. There's one person that signed up to testify, then have the CS brought back to us for committee action at the next hearing. Thank you, Mr. Usera. Could you stand by, please?
Thank you, yes.
Mr. Walter Johns? Thank you, Mr. Johns. If you want to identify yourself for the record and your affiliation, give us your testimony.
Yeah. My name is Sean Akwashai. My tax name is Walter Johns, and I am a shareholder of Sealaska Corporation and also of Gold Belt Incorporated. And I've been involved with corporations since they first started. You know, and I was looking at the bill, and I haven't really had a chance to really study and analyze it yet. But I always get concerned when the state does get involved with our companies, native companies. And I've been involved because I noticed that you're talking about proxies and that type of thing, so it's going to get into the election process. And I've been involved with 5 elections against the Alaska Corporation, and I won 3 of them. And I've also worked for the Alaska Corporation, and each time that I work for them, we won the election process. And I'm currently serving on a board for one of our corporations to the election process, and I'm just concerned that the changes that could come about could have a detrimental effect on native corporations. I know that right now there are many people that are native people that are against discretionary voting because they really don't understand, you know, the application and how you can use it for your benefit. When I ran an election for Sealaska Corporation, if we didn't have discretionary voting, we wouldn't have won the election. And I guess my major concern is it's not actually the wording of the bill, but it's the interpretation and the application of the bill. A good example of that was limited entry. When they were talking about that, I went to the A&B hall with fishermen and told them, you need to vote against this because it's going to be detrimental against our fishing fleets. We'll lose our fishing fleets. And they didn't believe me, and they supported it. And today we have no fishing fleets in any of our villages. They're gone. That was our livelihood. So that was stripped away from us from the limited entry bill. That was what they originally thought that it would limit people from Seattle area, that type, from coming into the state of Alaska, and that many people would have the upper hand, but it didn't work that way. And so I am concerned about this bill. I'm against this bill. I mean, I'd like to study it further, but like I said, my concern is not the actual wording, but the interpretation and the application once it passes. I'm concerned about the Native corporations, the costs. I guess you've heard testimony from people that work for us on Gold Belt, how it'll be detrimental to to Gold Belt. I'm not speaking about that right now because it's already been spoken to by someone more eloquent than I am, and that works day to day with the company, that type of thing, you know. But I do have some concerns about this bill, and I'm against it. I would prefer that we just leave it the way it is right now. You know, I mean, it is working. We do have, I live in Colorado, but if I have to come up here for meetings, and someone told me that someone made a statement that some of the corporations write their annual their reports on napkins. That's not true. That has never happened. And you know what I mean. And what's that?
Mr. Chairman, nobody said that.
Oh, is that right? Well, that's just what someone had told me, that they heard that was said. But that's just not true, you know. So at this point in time, I just, I'm speaking against this bill. And if you have any questions,
questions by the committee.
Thank you. I'm sorry, if I saw your name written, I would use your name.
Walter Jones. Yeah.
I'll use that name because I didn't.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the other one written down.
I've never heard it labeled my tax name.
Yeah.
Right. That's an interesting concept. I guess my question is maybe philosophical, sir. Since you serve on the board of the Corporation of Sea Alaska,
yes. Gold Belt,
and in Gold Belt as well.
Yeah, but I'm not speaking on. I'm just speaking as.
No, but I'm just saying that since you serve on those boards, is it? Do you consider that corporations in the state of Alaska are of equal value to the state of Alaska in the sense that they fall under an umbrella of equal laws?
Well, yeah, I guess they do, but what I get concerned about is not specifically the laws, but the interpretation and the application of the laws. You know what I mean? I mean, that's where I get concerned on how laws can be interpreted and how they can be applied, and that's what my concern is with the little that I've read here.
Sir, are you aware of the number of cases that we've heard of people that have indicated that they weren't given due process in the corporate?
Yes, we hear it all the time. I've worked with the election process since it first started, and I can tell you right now that 30% of the people, no matter what you do, will be against the corporation. They will vote against. Senior right now, who gives good dividends, if there's a move right now to remove the board of directors, there's always people that don't like what's going on and will speak against the corporations. I mean, that is a given. You know, when I run the elections, we know that 30% will be against the corporation, probably 30 will be for, and we fight for the rest, you know, to get them to vote for it. But there will always be people that will speak out no matter what the corporations do, just like you guys, you know. I mean,
sure.
There's always people that speak against you.
Well, I guess my question is, sir, from a fiduciary responsibility for all the people of Alaska, for our responsibility is to make sure it's an even playing field for all the people who are members of corporations, as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to do, as far as I can see, is that we're trying to make sure that there's a level playing field.
Well, in that process of making it level, what will the additional cost be to the corporations?
I don't want to get in an argument with you here, sir, but I would suggest to you it may be immaterial whether or not you appreciate what the state is trying to do if we believe, as a legislature, that it's as a policy, it's in the best interest of all the people of Alaska to have the same rules to live by.
Yeah. Well, as far as I can see, we have the same rules. I have run elections and won elections by using the current laws that exist today. What many of the people want to do is do away with discretionary voting because they don't understand and know how to run an election. And so they don't win. And so they get mad and they get angry and they want to change the law, that type thing, you know what I mean? And if it's equally applied to all corporations and not just native corporations, that would be one thing, too.
But that's what I suggest it should be.
Yes, you know what I mean.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johns, for coming up to testify. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill?
Mr. Johns?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Representative. I just wanted to do a couple things. Can you clarify what you mean by discretionary voting?
That's through the election process. People can, on their proxy, they can sign discretionary voting, and then the corporation can use that to vote and distribute the votes to the candidates. All corporations do that.
Okay. It's a proxy, right?
Yeah. That's a problem. And many of the what you call dissidents, which I was and have done that, don't understand how it works, so they don't like discretionary voting because they don't know how to use it, so they speak against it and they want to get rid of it. But it's the best tool that you can have for a dissident if they know how to use that tool.
Okay.
Thank you. And, Mr. Johns, I guess where I'm trying to figure out is that, like in Section 1 here, all it's requiring is that copies of the reports and proxy statements and all those things have to be filed with the state. But it changes the amount of the number of people. So if there's 250 shareholders instead of 500 shareholders, did you object to that provision?
What my concern is for the native corporations that are struggling financially and really can't afford to, you know, it costs money to like for Goldville, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of minimally $50,000 to have an election process. It would be more if we went back to our the way we ran our election, like be $150,000. So it's additional cost to the corporation, and if the company is struggling financially, a handful of people could come into the state and say, you know, we want this, and then they have to go through the process, and, you know, maybe they can't afford to distribute. If you're broke and don't have money, what you're going to do? And then what would the state do? I mean, that's my concern right now, you know, because there are some companies that are in that predicament today.
Well, there's a lot we can bite off but couldn't chew. There's a lot to do, and we have 41 days left in the session. It may be time to look at an omnibus act, but we're not going to do it this year, nor use this bill as a vehicle. I thought it was advantageous to hear testimony on a broad range of issues to know what's out there. But
I speak against the bill, though.
Thank you. We got that in the record.
Thank you.
Any further public participation on this bill? If not, we're going to close public participation on House Bill 527. Bring the committee substitute before us next week for committee action. And right now, Representative Guerra, if you want to come forward, we have our House Bill 690, Public Health Hazards.
No. I can talk about that.
Why don't you sit down,
yeah,
Representative Guerra. This is, go ahead.
April
this
Fool.
Is to prohibit spandex in public places.
This is your bill.
And toupees.
It would require, you'd have to have a permit to use spandex, Representative Guerra. What foolishness is this, sir?
Mr. Speaker, I already get a permit every time I wear spandex, Mr. Chair.
April Fool. We are going to hopefully take action on House Bill 459 today. There's a number of committee amendments that the sponsor and the committee have worked out through the Lieutenant Governor's Office and the Division of Elections. And why don't we go through those seriatim, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Do you want to be Speaker? Do you have any urge to be Speaker?
We already did that.
You wouldn't be bad, I don't think. current one has a pretty decent job. The Mr. Chair, yeah, last night I sat down with Lieutenant Governor's office to.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Sure, Les Guerra, District 23. Last evening I sat down with representatives of the Division of Elections and Lieutenant Governor's office to see what concerns they had about the bill. Their concerns are addressed in these three amendments. So
we have before CS for House Bill number 459, State Affairs. Let's take the Q version. Which one are we doing first?
The one that starts with insert at page 2, line 9.
Page 2, line 9.
One of the concerns we went back and forth about is how widespread these new optical scan machines are going to become. And the Lieutenant Governor's office explained that they have no intention of using more than one of these machines in any precinct, that they're just there for those who feel they would like to use them, mostly people with visual impairments. So this amendment confirms that intention, that except for in certain places where maybe a larger number of people with visual impairments might be, like we might have, for example, a special polling place for people with visual impairments in Anchorage. So in those places, we might have more than one machine. But otherwise, there will only be one of these machines in any precinct.
Okay,
and so that's
going to move amendment number one for discussion purposes. We're going to consider this a conceptual amendment. I don't understand, though, page 2, line 9 of the CS, it starts section 3.
That was bunker.
Oh, I beg your pardon. It would be a new section 15.
Yeah.
I guess. I'm with you. Any questions about amendment number 1? No objection to amendment number 1. See no objection. Amendment number 1 is adopted.
Thank you.
And Garrett, amendment 2 is which one?
Amendment number 2 is, says delete page 2, lines 14 through 17.
14 through 17. Okay. Amendment 2. I'm going to move amendment 2. Representative Guerra, why don't you discuss what Lieutenant Governor's concerns were in this amendment?
The Director of the Division of Elections was scared that she would be given certification duties that she wouldn't be able to undertake. And as it turned out, the current law provides that election equipment, including software and computer equipment, needs to be certified and tested before every election. That's in 15-20-900. And so we just emphasize that rule applies to these DRE machines and the software in these DRE machines by deleting the current language at subsection B on line 14 and just incorporating the existing certification and testing requirements that we have under current law. So it's just a new subsection B.
That was something I had added, and appreciate the clarification and the making it shorter. Any comments on amendment number 2? Any objections? Seeing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. Amendment number 3, I'm going to move amendment number 3, delete page 2, lines 4 to 8. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is the only one that involves any policy call by the committee. Laura Glazer from the Division of Elections is here. As the bill is written, tries to limit the use of these DRE machines as much as possible until the evidence helps us develop a better comfort level with them. So currently the bill says, well, if somebody says they need to use one of these machines, then they can use one of these. It's just based on their statement that they need to use it. The Division of Elections said, well, if you make somebody who has a visual impairment say they need to use the machine, that would be unfair to somebody with a handicap or visual impairment. I think their position is, why should you ask somebody to highlight a handicap they might have? So the language here just says the voter just has to request the use of the machine. It's a policy call. This one maybe will allow the machines to be used a little bit more as opposed to the existing language. But
just a Representative Seed, could you object to the Amendment 3, please?
I object.
Okay. We have Ms. Glazer here. We would like to get your input, too, on this one. When Ms. Glazer, if you could come forward, identify yourself for the record, then we have committee comments. If you both could stay up, then we'll just be able to move more expeditiously. Ms. Glazer, if you could identify.
Mr. Chairman, Laura Glazer, Director of Division of Elections.
Why don't you offer your testimony on this, and then we'll turn to questions.
I'm guessing that you walked through the amendments that we talked about.
Yeah, we've done about one and two. We're on amendment number 3, which
asserts
by a voter.
Do you want me to start from the beginning or just this one?
Just this amendment.
The concern we had was we are going to limit the the implementation. I know the representative had a concern. He never testified on the record to this. Yes, we have 100. Because when we bought 100, as I testified the other day, the concerns had not risen to the forefront, and we didn't realize that there would be this many concerns. So we were going to back up implementation anyway. But we are going to put them in the regional supervisor's offices, and hopefully with the piece of legislation we'll have before you, hopefully next week, we're going to increase early voting, and early voting allows us to have all 40 ballots available. So if we have these machines in the regional offices, then anyone who needs to use them could go to a regional office to do that. We'd also like to, with early voting, expand it to Access Alaska, where the people who would be most likely to need these machines would be able to use them, would have the service, the van, to bring them to vote. So that was our hope and intent. But the problem with putting a machine and just saying and separating somebody out, segregating out a group of voters, the whole Division of Elections, all the staff had a little concern about that, and as did the Lieutenant Governor's office. And so that's why we recommended this language. We are not going to do any voter outreach. We're not going to, get everybody all excited to use the machine. But if the machine is in the regional office and somebody walks up and says, I need to use that machine, we'll let them use it. But we don't expect there to be a big groundswell. We will do the outreach to the people that need to use it. We will go in and do the outreach with the disabled and visually impaired and blind.
Thank you, Ms. Glazer. We had Representative Grunberg first and then Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I was one of the people that was kind of slow in using the Alaska Airlines touch machine. And now I think they're great. And I would hope that you would let people use these machines who wanted to, because I probably would want to just try them out. If Amendment 3 passes, will you let people do it who want to use them?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, yes, that was the discussion we had last night with the sponsor, was that, yes, we didn't want to be in a place of blocking someone who really wanted to use the machine. I think most of you are familiar with your poll workers. You know, we're not going to have them, not to be facetious, but, have a 70-year-old lady doing a body check on a big guy who wants to use the machine. You know, we want to leave that access open, but also to be more clear, these won't be in a polling place in 04, except for, Access Alaska, and if we have a call, like, from Pioneer Homes or something. And again, I would be happy if, you want me to notify you where we think our plans are, but... it will be limited use to those who are most needy.
Representative Holm, then Rebecca. Okay,
just on that point, I want to flip that coin over just
sure.
a little bit.
Sure.
Are you going to make sure that everybody knows they're available?
Yeah, that was my next question.
Representative Holm, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. We had intended to do that when this concern, the concern that you don't want very many people to use it. I'm a little confused at what direction...
Right.
Is before me.
That's why I answered the question.
I'm saying, based on this and the discussion, testimony, emails I've received, phone calls I've received, that what you're saying is I have to be true to what I promised the Lieutenant Governor, which is to make sure that his promise to Sandy Sanderson and Lynn Corral on the Frank Haas bill is honored. So I know that I have to make those machines available to the blind and visually impaired and disabled. But if the legislature gives us direction and says, Let's keep the lid on in 04. We don't have verifiable paper receipts. That's what we think the answer is. Then we'll limit its usage. So, but I'm not going to block. Again, if it's in a regional office and any of you walk in and say, I want to use that machine, this language right here would say, and the way we would implement it in the division is, in a regional supervisor's office, they would be allowed to use it.
Just a quick follow-up. You said you'd ordered these machines. Where are they now?
Mr. Chairman, the machines are in each of the regional offices. They were distributed because, as I said on Tuesday, we had a plan to do distribution through the state, limited distribution through the state, and so they've been placed.
Maybe if you get something around here, maybe you can let the legislature know. We can take a look and see.
And Mr. Chairman, that's our intent. We went through our final training, I think last week or the week before, so we would be able to answer most of your questions.
Put quarters in them?
Or by a vote?
Representative Gruenberg.
What I would like, and so speaking personally, when we talk about informing the voters, I would like the division to let people know you have these machines where they are, but that there is no paper trail and they have been known to malfunction. And that way it's the voter's choice.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, the discussion that that we had yesterday with the sponsor, Annette Kreitzer, Lieutenant Governor's Chief of Staff, brought up that we could sign the machine saying, you know, a sign above the optical scans would be there for the early voting. These machines do not provide, provide a paper trail. They provide a paper ballot. These machines do not. And, you know, and there's no way to check the vote. You know, we don't have that language narrowed down. But just so that people understand, this one you won't see a paper ballot. It's all in the computer. This one there is not. And so we were going to, I believe she made you that commitment that we would, you know, we would designate
and
the difference.
And that keeps the promise intact for the Lieutenant Governor, too, as well. Is that right, Ms. Glazer?
Yes. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gruenberg, follow up?
Yeah. The sign has got to be in a form that is also understandable to the people who can't read, so it has to be copyright available in Braille, too, I would think. And finally, I think that's a very good idea, and I'd like to have you do that. On the amendment itself, we are deleting subsection A, and I think this is excellent in place of sub A, but I'm wondering, do you want to keep sub B in?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, we had that discussion last night, and I don't know whether there's another amendment pending, but we had talked about if, in fact, your concern is about these machines, as I testified on Monday, there's never been a decision by the division. The major default in the state of Alaska is a paper ballot. There will be a paper ballot in every precinct. So. That may not be necessary language because the default in an emergency, if you really are concerned about using these machines, the default in an emergency is always paper. These are driven by power while they have a battery backup and can't operate. The default is still the paper ballot.
I think that using the papers, so I like the way the amendment is taken.
I just had a quick question. Representative Lynn, I had a quick question. On the amendment, wouldn't it be after on line 3, generated ballots, and then delete but only, and then A and B, generated ballots by a voter. Since you're doing away with A and B, would just be the director may provide for voting by use of electronically generated ballots by a voter? Who?
Mr. Chair, I think with or without the language, it reads the same. One is, I guess, by leaving the language in, I guess it emphasizes a little bit, but it means the same thing with or without that language, so you could easily take that language out if you didn't want it to be there. Since we don't have an A and B anymore, and it's only one sentence now, you could take that out easily or just leave it in. It doesn't matter.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, this goes somewhere towards solving one of my concerns, and that is the identifiability of people's ballots, because it'd be a very, if you only have two people using a machine or even one person using this machine, because of restrictions on other people using them, then all of a sudden we know, you know, the division's going to know how people voted, or a certain person voted. And so I think that taking all the but would be, but only would be advantageous. So I'd still move that we add that to the amendment.
Just deleting but only?
Deleting but only.
Is there objection to deleting but only on page 3?
Let me
do this. We have amendment number 3 before us. There's an objection by Representative Seaton. Is there further discussion on the amendment number 3?
My suggestion, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, is that we amend the amendment to also delete on line 3 the phrase comma but only.
Is there objection?
That's a judiciary.
Yes, that's a. This doesn't have a judiciary phrase. Well, without objection, we will delete the comma but only on page 2, line 3, add that as a friendly amendment to amendement number 3.
No agreement by objection from amendment 3.
Is there further objection to amendment number 3 as amended? Seeing none, amendment number 3 as amended is adopted. Is there further discussion on this? CS, we do have one person signed up for public testimony, and then I'm going to close public testimony.